Most of the second half of the 20th century, accelerator-based high-energy physics was the paradigmatic kind of physics. We got ever bigger accelerators built. Synchrotron radiation was just a waste product that just happened to be created whenever you accelerated electrons. And access to those synchrotron radiation beams was granted more or less grudgingly by the high-energy physicists to other less fundamental physicists, like solid-state physicists or even molecular biologists. That has changed quite a bit in the last few decades. It's becoming more and more common to build large accelerators, large particle accelerators, not to study the particles by smashing them into one another, but to use these electromagnetic radiation that was originally considered a waste for other purposes like material sciences or biology. Robert Feidenhandel is the chairman and managing director of the European EXFEL in Hamburg, which operates one of the most advanced of these new kind of accelerators. And he wants to tell us about the new paradigm in science that these devices enable. Have much fun with Robert Feidenhandel.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the introduction. I hope that the technical difficulties are over now, so we'll see. So I will tell about X-ray free electron lasers. I call my talk A New Paradigm in Science. I hope that the translator can follow, because I'm a fast speaker. So on this first slide, you see the opening of the free electron laser with the green laser from the Elbphilharmonie. You see the free electron laser in the middle, and you see the directors of European EXFEL to the right. You see me with that's the guy with the gray hair in the back. So I'll give you a personal view on where we are with all this here. So European EXFEL, it's a European facility. You see the shareholder countries, it's X-rays. We want to see atoms and molecules, so you need X-rays with the short wavelengths. We use free electrons, and we have a laser. And I think it's quite timely to give the talk now, because it's actually nearly 125 years ago we had the anniversary for the first X-ray image, which was taken on the 22nd of December 1895. So this is what I'm going to tell about. What are free electron lasers? What is European X-ray? What's your organization? What's the layout? How do we actually do science? And then at the very, very end, tell a little bit about why it's important to do this kind of science. So my background here, I have nearly 40 years of experience in X-ray science. I'm coming from Denmark. I'm actually sitting now in Roskilde in Denmark right now. I'm a professor at the Niels Bohr Institute in Copenhagen. I've been in Hamburg since 2017. And as you see from, I don't know how many physicists are among you, then the physicists probably know PhD comics. And this is Professor Smith. And I'm nearly looking the same. And as Professor Smith, I've not done experiments or data analysis for years, so I'm just the managing director. So as you heard in the introduction, X-rays for science is today generated by synchrotron radiation facilities, and lately also by X-ray free electron lasers. So you see this plot here, which shows the quality factor or the power of X-rays, called average brilliance, as a function of years. And you see from about 1960, the quality of X-rays has increased dramatically. So this increase here, which is basically a logarithmic growth here, it's the growth faster than Moore's law. And all of you know Moore's law, and this year it even grows faster, which gives us problems, because our data generation is basically proportional with the brilliance. So we produce data faster than the increase in Moore's law. And I have been in the field since 1981, where I was a summer student at DC in Hamburg. And I can tell you it has been a fantastic experience. following this increase of more than 10 orders of magnitude during your career. So what are X-ray free electron lasers? So X-ray free electron lasers, as you heard in the introduction, this is the accelerator. It's based on accelerators. So you have an accelerator of electrons, which on the left you have the electron emitter, where you emit electrons by the laser. You have a LINAC to accelerate the electrons. You have a bunch compressor to make them very short. You have electron bunch, which is very short. You have another LINAC. You put electrons through an undulator, where the electrons do a sinusoidal path, where they produce X-rays, and then you throw away the electrons in an electron beam dump. And you need to have X-rays for the kind of science we want to do, because we want to see atom cell molecules, and X-rays are very energetic light particles, photons, and therefore you need a long and big accelerator. So the undulators that produce light looking like this here, these are magnetic devices where the electrons go. When you go through the undulator, they take a sinusoidal path. We have about three of these undulators, and each of them is about 150 meters long. So it's a huge piece of infrastructure with very, very many single magnets. So the whole trick about lasers is that you need coherent light. You need to have the particles that emit light to be organized in a certain array. On the left, you see a non-coherent bunch, which are electrons normally generating light in a synchrotron. We want to align them to have a coherent bunch, so they all send out light that is being amplified coherently. And the way you do that is you do it by lasing in one pass. So we use a principle called self-amplified spontaneous emission, which was introduced by Evgeny Saldin on the left. You see him on the left, where he received a prize. He invented this idea in Novosibirsk in the late 70s in the last century. And the principle was then further developed. The idea is that you have the long undulator. You see here the undulator with the green and yellow, the green and red magnets. The electrons go through the undulator. The electrons follow the yellow path. They wiggle up and down. They emit light. Every time they accelerate, they emit light. The lights get stronger and stronger. It interacts with the electron beam and then aligns up the electrons. So you see that in the lower chart here, the electron cloud coming in is homogeneous. Then it goes along the undulator, where it starts to get sliced up into certain slices. At the very end, you have a micro-bunched electron cloud where all the electrons emit light coherently, and you get a extremely powerful X-ray beam coming out, and then you throw away the electrons. So you only use the electrons once. So here's the European X-Fell in a nutshell in Hamburg. At Schönefeld, you see the Daisy Barnfeld campus, where we start, and then in Schönefeld, just across the border to Schleswig-Holstein, you then see the European X-Fell. So the electron injector starts in Barnfeld, where the electrons are injected into the accelerator. It's a superconducting accelerator, so the accelerator is cooled down to 2 Kelvin, and that have special properties which I'll come back to. Here you see the a small movie. I hope you can see the movie. Can anybody tell me whether your movie can be seen? No. Okay. I hope you can
see. It's okay. Yeah.
You see the movie. Okay, good. So you see the electrons are being accelerated through the 2 Kelvin cold niobium cavities. Then we have the undulator systems where here in Osterwobborn. And then we have experimental stations out here for research. And you see here, again, this is the undulator system I showed you before. The electrons are passing through the undulator, and then you can can follow them. This is you undulate, and soon you see the electrons are going there. You can see, due to the magnetic structure, they wiggle forth and back, forth and back, and you see the electron, the light is being emitted, that you see as a the white cloud, and then at the end they then send out a big burst of photons. And here is the experimental station, the experimental hall, where we do experiments. So you have three undulators. We call them SARS-1, SARS-2, and SARS-3. And then we have six experimental stations where we use this very powerful X-ray beam coming out to do experiments. You see here the two beam dumps where we throw away the electrons called XXDU1 and XXDU2. That's the beam dumps. And then you have the six experiments where we do different kind of experiments. I'll come back to that. Here's a typical instrument station. The X-rays are coming from the right, going towards the left. At the first you see some various optics where you can manipulate the X-ray beam. You can focus it. You can measure how intense it is. Then in the middle with this blue bar, you have an experiment where the X-rays are scattered off a sample. Then you have a detector, and I will come back to the detector here. This is this big piece with the yellow front, and then you have a monitoring system at the very end. So this is a typical person will be as big of as this detector. This robot arm is actually to manipulate another detector. The sample is sitting just in front of the robot arm. And here's the detectors. I'll come back to the detectors later on. They produce a tremendous amount of data, which we then need to analyze. This is a large pixel detector, a 1 million pixels in kind. It's delivered by the UK. And here is people we have all this for. This is a user community. So we are a user facility where people can book in and do an experiment via proposal. A typical group here, you see six, seven, eight different groups. They come in, do an experiment for about 5 days or 60 hours, five times 12 hours. You either measure during the night or during the day, and in the end we hope that we can do 200 of these user experiments per year. So a user group is basically 10 to 100 people consisting of different university or different institutes that come and do the experiments together with us. So here's a little bit about the facts of the European X-FIL. As I said, it's a user facility, so the science we do is determined by our users. We have 12 member countries. Germany pays a little bit more than half, 58%. Russia, which is a little bit unusual, pays 27%. So a big, about a quarter. And all the other countries, the remaining 10 countries, contribute between 1% and 3% of the construction and operational costs. Daisy runs the accelerator for us. We are about 500 people on the Schenefeld side for the doing the experiments and the maintenance and administration, etc. And Daisy has about 250 people running the accelerators. It costed about 1.5 billion euros to build it in 2018 prices, and the running cost is about 135 million a year. And you see, our end goal will be to do about 200 user experiments per year. We are not there yet, but we have only been operating for about 3 years. So where are we in the world? We are not the only one who have a heart X-ray free ultrasound laser. The first one was in Stanford at LCLS in 2009. They opened. Then the Japanese came 2 years after in 2011. Then the Swiss in 2016, and the Koreans also in 2016. And the number you should take note of here is how many X-ray pulses per second will come. The X-ray facility is a pulse source, so you get a number of pulses per second, and these facilities here deliver between 60 and 120 pulses per second. Here, European X-Fill is very particular because we have the superconducting accelerator where we have a megahertz sponge structure, so we have a burst mode where we have 10 bursts of very strong X-rays coming per second, and in these bursts we have up to 2,700 X-ray pulses. So in total, we can deliver 27,000 X-ray pulses per second, but they come in this burst mode where every tenth of a second we have a new burst of X-rays coming in. And that makes us the most powerful X-ray source in the world. So we want to measure atomic motion. We want to see how atoms and molecules are moving. We want to measure on very short time scale. But what is the time scale of the atoms? Now, for humans, you would say the time scale, our time scale is actually milliseconds, because that's sort of the time scale we move on. If you drive a car and the car in front of you stops, you need to react within milliseconds. Now, the interesting time scale, while the interesting time scale for humans is milliseconds, it's femtoseconds for atoms. And you can see that by the speed of sound in a material. It's 3,000 meters per second. The distance between atoms is 3 angstroms. Then we can say that sort of the interesting time scale is about 100 femtoseconds. So that is the time scale you want to do experiments if you want to see atoms move, as you see in this acoustic vibration you see up there. So that's the interesting time scale. And that is exactly the time scale of the pulses coming out of our Friedrichshain lasers. If you look at the synchrotron radiation light on the left, which is a picture facility at DESI, there you get about 10 to the 9 photons, light particles per pulse, and the pulse length is about 100 picoseconds, which is much longer than 100 femtoseconds. So the FEL will give you 10 to the 13 photons in about 200 femtoseconds. So we have an enormous amount of photons on a very short time scale. And that's the difference between X-ray lasers and synchrotron radiation. So we measure time, we measure the dynamics on a very short time scale. This also makes that we have an extremely and exceptionally strong X-ray beam. Normally, you would say you can stop X-rays by, for instance, lead that can shield the X-ray beam, so it's not harmful. But with this X-ray beam we have, which is a very strong laser beam, it can be focused to a few microns. If you do that, then you can drill a hole through a piece of steel in less than half a minute. You can see here a piece of steel on the left. It's 5 centimeters thick, and you can see the entrance hole to the lower right and the exit hole to the upper right. And within half a minute, the X-ray beam has basically drilled a hole through this piece of steel, because it's so intense, and it comes with such a short pulse that it drains the plasma and the material evaporates. So if you focus the beam, nothing can actually stop it. And therefore, we have to have very special safety requirements around our experiments. Now, this here, I don't know whether it actually works. This could show you the X-ray beam where we have a tube on the right. And now I let it run, and then I just hope you can see it. And then you would see in a few seconds the X-ray beam come. So this is the X-ray beam that goes into ionizes the air, and it basically drills hole in the air. Penetration here is much longer than you would have anticipated, and the noise which you might hear is the 10 hertz noise. So every time you see a burst coming in, it ionizes the air and shows this kind of light here. I hope you saw it. Did you see it? Can somebody tell me where you actually saw this small movement?
Yes, there was some movement. The bad part, okay, played a bit into the audio, but okay.
Okay, good. Okay, So how do we then do the experiments? Now I told you about the whole setup. Now I go a little bit back and look, say, how did I do experiments when I was young, or how did you do data collection the traditional way? So I took here the example of the double helix. On the left, you have Rosalind Franklin, who was the woman who actually took the first diffraction data of DNA, which you see in the middle there, diffraction data. You saw a sample, which was a kind of a few crystals. And from such diffraction data, you could actually solve the structure. And you see the double helix structure here with James Watson and Francis Crick to the right. By the way, our guest house at the Schönefeld campus, you have Rosalind Franklin on the front of the building. But basically in those days, you had one crystal, you took one diffraction data, and you took one crystal off. So this is how I looked in the 80s, early 90s. When we did the experiments at DAISY, we had one sample which we spent. We prepared that for weeks and prepared and shined. And so in this case, it was a precious gold sample. Then we studied this only sample for 1 or 2 weeks. And then we went home with a small data set afterwards. This is not how we do the experiments today. We do it in a radically different manner. Now, but how do we do experiments? Because I told you this exceptionally strong beam that would drill holes in a piece of steel. So how can you study anything with such a powerful beam? Because it will get destroyed. And yes, the samples are destroyed. And this was shown here in about 20 years ago in one of the first studies. Can you at all study samples with such a strong beam? And here is a sample of a protein, the exploding protein, where you need to beat the radiation damage, because I showed you that the sample will evaporate. So can you take data from the sample before it evaporates? And here you see a protein you put into a beam, and then you see after the beam hits it at zero, time equals to zero, then you see how the sample looks at 2 femtoseconds, 5 femtoseconds, 10 femtoseconds, 20 femtoseconds. And it shows you have to be extremely fast to actually do the experiment to reconstruct how the sample actually looks. But you need a very short pulse in order to do that. And that's exactly what we have, a pulse which is a few tenths of femtoseconds long, so you can actually take the picture of the sample. So the first experiment here was done also at DAISY, where they used a smaller X-ray facility than the one we have, where you took had a piece of silicon where you had an engraved two men and a sun. Can see a scanning electron microscopy picture of it here. Then you put it took the sample, put it into the beam, recorded the diffraction image, and you see that over here on the upper left. And from that diffraction image, you can actually reconstruct how the sample looked, and that you see on the to the right, where you see the reconstruction of the two men and the sun. Now, if you take a second shot on this sample, then you see the scattering image on the lower left. Well, there's actually nothing, because the sample has completely evaporated. So it shows the first beam is so powerful that it destroys your sample, but you can actually collect data fast enough that you can reconstruct the sample and calculate how it actually looked. So this was an extremely important proof of principle that you are able to take your scattering data so fast that they can actually see how the sample looked. So the way the experiments are done today is done in a completely different manner. So here's a sketch where you have this kind of yellow thing coming in. And these are the X-ray pulses which are coming in this burst mode with 10 of these X-ray pulses per second. Then you have a jet of sample which is shown in green. These are small crystals of some kind of protein you want to study. And then you look at the diffraction image to the upper right. And then you just shoot instead of only one sample, you have millions of samples and millions of scattering images. You don't know how the atoms are looking, how they're organized, but that you can sort of afterwards if you have a sufficient amount of data. So here's what you call in serial femtosecond crystallography. It's the same experiment. You have a lot of different scattering images here. You have the samples coming in through this jet, GDVN, that the jet coming in. You can see if it works. I don't know how the movie works. You can see it, a real jet on the lower right. On my screen, it's a movie where you can see a jet coming in from the right. When the X-ray beam hits the jet, it evaporates, and therefore you see it gets sistered up. And from these millions of scattering images, you can then calculate a structure of this protein they wanted to study here on the right, where you see the different atoms and molecules. But you need to collect a lot of data. So here's one example of science that has been done, where they did a proof of principle. Instead of looking at proteins, they looked at millions of gold nanocrystals. You can see them on the upper right. You then spray them very fast into the X-ray beam, and then you collect just everything you can. In this case, it's 10 million diffraction images were collected, and then you sort off the data afterwards and see what samples, how did your samples actually look. And then you can classify, in this case, that you had four different kinds of samples that you can do afterwards. You don't need to do that in forehand. You just take all the samples you have, throw them into the beam, and then via the software afterwards, you can then calculate what kind of structures they actually are. And that is what I mean, that it's a completely different way of doing science. And instead of one sample, you have millions of samples, and then you look afterwards what kind of samples did you actually have. And it doesn't need to be homogeneous. Here's maybe a little bit clumsy overhead formation of water bubbles and experiments that were done about a year ago at the European Expo, where they looked at water bubbles, creation of water bubbles. How is a water bubble actually formed? In the very first nanoseconds or femtoseconds after it's created. And they had a laser to create water bubbles. They looked at it with X-rays, and then they just look at millions of water bubbles and then see, by looking at the images of the water bubble, how they how they actually grow, how fast they do, what's the density, and they can see that the water bubble is completely empty in the middle, and just at the rim of the water bubble, the density of water is 40 to 50% higher than normal water. Then you can study the statistics by looking at these millions of water bubbles. Another type of experiments we are doing is we're looking at fundamental interaction and timescales. Something which is also important for you is magnetism, where you store data. You need to understand how is the interaction between electrons, the spins of the electrons and the lattice, and to see how is this interaction in order to design new magnetic devices that can switch much faster than the ones we have today. So magnetism is actually one of the key areas that we are looking into. And here we had an experiment where we looked at magnetic multilayers by a group from ITMO in St. Petersburg, where you can see the magnetic structure is changing as a function of time on the picosecond timescale. So I gave you some examples of what we're doing. What we really want to do is to look at the molecular movies where we, for instance, trigger a process in a protein and a photoactive protein. You see that on the right, where you have a protein, it's excited by an orange optical laser. Then you have a blue X-ray probe beam coming in. You scatter off, and from that you can then calculate the structure of the protein. On the left, you see the way we're doing experiments, where we put in the many proteins into the beam, measure a certain time delay, calculate the structure. And if you then measure several time delays, so you see what happens after 10 femtoseconds, 20 femtoseconds, 100 femtoseconds after you hit the protein by the optical laser, you can then put together a number of still pictures and make molecular movies. And that is what we really want to do at our facility. And the first of this kind of studies were done here. This is a paper from, I think it was this year, by Marius Schmidt from Arizona, where they looked at the photoactive yellow protein, where you can see from the left, it's 3 picoseconds, 10 picoseconds, so 30 80 and 100 picoseconds after you have excited this protein with a laser, a normal optical laser pulse. And that's important to understand how photosynthesis actually works in nature in these kind of proteins. So that will be one of the main focus areas for our facility. So here you can see the data that has been taken at the UOP Nexwell. Good. So now I told you a little bit about the science we are doing. I hope you got a glimpse of the variety from nanoscience to magnetism to biocrystallography, and we do many other things. But maybe I'll also show a little bit about the complexity of experiments we are actually doing with a special focus on the data. So here you have all the different or part of the different things that you need to have control of. You have the accelerator, which actually works exceptionally well. We have X-ray optics to focus X-ray beam. We need to measure photon diagnostics to see where is the beam, how intense is it. We need optical lasers to excite the samples, as I just showed you. We need a sample delivery, this jet of samples that is coming in with a very high speed. And that's also a lot of technology. And then we need our detectors where we measure the scattered photons, and then we need to analyze the immense amount of data we actually take. We have a data department which is in charge of detectors, the electronics, the controls, the data management, and the data analysis. And we have about 100 staff working on this at UOP Nexwell. So here's the, here's the way the experiment is done. You have the high rep rate of X-ray bursts coming into the, hitting the sample jet. You have the detectors where we collect all the data. And we collect free fast 520 frames per second in this detector here. So here's the adaptive gain detector. It can switch the gain. It's a detector which has about 1 million calibration parameters. So it's a very complicated beast. Here's the pulse structure. And we have these pulses coming in this burst mode. And within the burst, you don't have time to read off the detector. So you need to store. This detector can store 352 frames on the detector, and then between the bursts, where you nearly have a tenth of a second, then you can read out all this data and store them away. So here's the piece of this AGIP detector. Here's the second one coming. So it's really this is the first experiment done with this detector. You see, we're very pleased, and it produces a lot of data. Now I go a little bit back and look here. When I started data analysis in real time, so when I started here, you see on this plot on the left, the data came out on a piece of paper, you know, this teletype. You see the guy on the right, and then we looked. We had the numbers plotted here on this piece of paper. Took a pocket calculator and then calculated how many counts did we actually have in this peak as subtracted the background. The data didn't come much faster than you could do that with a pocket calculator. The data storage, by the way, was a little bit old-fashioned, because we actually stored the data on paper. So you saw this guy on the right. where he's doing some data analysis looking for a particular scan. And then we collected this data in boxes, and then we drove home with 10 boxes of paper, which was the data we actually took. And then we have analyzed the data on the way with a pocket calculator and nicely written them down into a logbook. Here you can see we also got a little bit more advanced and made a small script where you can actually automatically calculate the intensity of the peak. We are far from that now. There's been a tremendous development. We have, when I started, we had detectors that could measure whether it was a photon or not. Today, we have two-dimensional detectors where you can also see where on the detector did the photon actually hit. And they are time-resolved. You know, we have detectors which measure now with megahertz repetition rate. So here's the data storage when about 20 years ago. We had more data storage about 2011, and I still remember that when I went home from experiments that was in Switzerland, when we did experiments, we had bought 10 of these data devices, and we carried them home in Aldi plastic boxes. So you see, this is completely outrageous today. So here's how it works at European X-Field. We have on the left, you can see how much data we have collected 2019, about 10 petabyte, a little bit less in 2020 due to the pandemic, so we could not really collect data. You can see on the plot on the right, you have the data size in petabyte, then you can see the date, and then you can see how the amount of data we have stored, the raw data we have stored, is actually increasing. And the flat horizontal plateau, that's where we stopped this summer due to the COVID-19. We had no experiments running. And all the vertical lines, that's where the AGIP detector starts to work, and then we really produce a lot of raw data. So this is one of the biggest challenges we have, is to manage and manipulate and analyze a huge amount of data. So where are we actually with this here? You can see the detectors. We have the various, we have several types of AGIP detectors. We have a LPD detector I also showed you. I could see sort of the data range that we are collecting, the amount of raw data. And for comparison, you can see, I also listed here the amount of data that comes out of the CERN detector. So we basically produce data at the moment is at the same amount of CERN. Now, one of our biggest challenges is data reduction that's built in the detectors at CERN, that they only measure the good events, where we collect all the data that the detectors actually measuring without checking whether it's good or bad. And there's a special challenge here that physicists are emotionally attached to the data. Now, as soon as they have the data, you can take away their husband or their wife, you can take away the kids or whatever, but you cannot take away the data. Then they take you to court for the human rights. So you have to analyze the data and reduce the data before you give it to the users. And that's one of the challenges that we're actually working on, not because at the moment we have data rates which is quite large. We also have to the different requirements. We need to store the data, we need to process the data, we need to transport the data. We have local resources at European X-Field. Then the data is transported to DAISY nearby, where they also stored, and then we have recently made a ultra fast data connection to NCBJ near Warsaw. We can have a 100 gigabytes per second data, so they could also participate in data analysis and data management. So this is a very interesting part of the challenge we have at European X-Field, the high data rates we are working on. Now, before I end here, I told you about some of the science we have been doing. I told you something about the data challenge we are actually having, and please, if you're interested, look on our website. If you want to look for jobs, we're always looking for good scientists and data and engineers. But then I'll just end up saying we have six experiments. They're all in user operation. You can see them here. The first started in September 17. The next started in the end of 18, and the last they got online in 19. And now they're all producing data, and they are and data is being published. We have many high impact publications, so we had actually a very good start. So that was about European Excel. But before I end, I will also tell a little bit about why is it that we at all do science? You know, what is it that actually comes out? And here I will end up by a few slides on the importance of large-scale facilities. And then I will put the question here, what is the most important outcome of CERN? What's the most important thing they have done? So first of all, they have discovered the Higgs boson. And second of all, they have created the World Wide Web. So what CERN has been doing, is doing, and what all large-scale facilities are doing, we do science and we do technology. And I think you have to understand both things are extremely important for the outcome of large-scale facilities. I have here taken a little bit looking at disruptive technologies over the last 100 years. And then we can speculate what's the role of large-scale infrastructures. Now, disrupt technology, I've taken a personal view here. So this here is my grandfather, Barthold, born in 1880 or something like that. He participated in the First World War. He was born in the northern part of Germany, at that time now in the southern part of Denmark. The most important for him, the most disruptive technology for him was the car. So the car changed his life. This is my father, Günther. He was born in 1929, and the thing that changed his life was the television. Now, this is me, some years younger, and what changed my life, which really was a disruptive technology, was the laptop. We all know this. I have been, when I did my master thesis, it was still on a normal typewriter where they have a correcting water, etc. I had all drawings had to be hand-drawn and photocopied in. This is my son, Nikolai. What changed his life is the iPhone, the handy. This has been his disruptive technologies. This is my grandson, Asker. Something will change his life. Something will be disruptive. What he's doing that his parents and grandparents did not do. I don't know what it is, but there will be something. Now, if you look and see, this, all these here contains basic sciences. The car, there's a lot of metallurgy and thermodynamics. The television, you know, there are Nobel Prizes into the television, the discovery of the electron, the transistor and stuff, the integrated circuits in my computer, the CCD camera in the handy. I'm pretty sure that whatever will change the life of Asker, there will be some Nobel Prizes behind it. And our role in all this here is that we study new materials, because all of these technologies I just show you, the basis of them is some new kind of materials, silicon or CCD devices, something that will create new technologies. Touchscreens, for instance, is something that has completely changed our life. And we are in for our role is to do advanced characterization techniques. And I show you here, it's not only European X-ray, there are synchrotron radiation sources, there are electron microscopes, there's neutron sources. We all are there to study materials and also biomolecules. That is what we are there for. And to end up with the very last slide, is the COVID-19. I think you can hardly do a talk these days without talking about the pandemic. So I allow myself here to have a slide on the pandemic and large-scale facilities. You here have seen these COVID-19 viruses. You have seen them, I know, a million times already. But you might have not thought about where do these images actually come from, because somebody has actually studied these viruses, the different parts of them, the different proteins, and then constructed these images. They are basis of science. And when the COVID-19 started, a lot of different groups started to study the various proteins, the viruses, etc., with electron microscopes and with synchrotron radiation. And here are some of the very first articles that came out in Science and Nature in March, April. The Chinese immediately went to their synchrotron, studied some structure-based design of candidates targeting this COVID-19 virus. There was a very nice study done in Germany by the group of Hildenfeld, where he also looked at some crystal structures. All that was done at the Bessie II synchrotron in Berlin. And of course, the Americans also used their advanced photon source, synchrotron radiation source in Argonne to do some of these studies here. And at least every region needs to have one of these facilities to do this kind of science. So what I say here, we have a vaccine based on science, a vaccine which I'll be proud of taking. I know it's based on a lot of science that has been done. And every, as I said, every region needs to have some of these large-scale facilities. Could you imagine that the Mrs. Merkel would have to call to China and say, oh, by the way, we have to study this. Can we borrow your synchrotron? Or could you imagine Merkel would call Trump and say, oh, could I lend you a synchrotron for a couple of days to study this protein? No, it's unthinkable. Unthinkable. Every region needs to have these large-scale facilities, synchrotrons, X-ray fields and lasers, neutron sources, and electron microscopes. That's an essential part of the infrastructure to be able to attack such crisis that we had with the pandemic. And I think with that, I would say, end my talk. It's a little bit too late to say Merry Christmas, but I can at least say Happy New Year. And now I don't know what's going to happen.
Okay, thank you for your talk. Now we'll have a short Q&A session. There have been some questions from the audience and Twitter and IRC. I think most are asking probably a bit personal question. What made you choose this venue for your talk? Well, most probably don't expect the chairman of an international research institution at a hacker conference. So we're glad you're here, but why did you choose it?
I chose this. I said I want to tell what we're actually doing. I want to tell what kind of science we're doing. And then I hope I give you a flavor of the challenges that we have with our detectors, with our electronics, and with our data analysis.
Yes. And another question, what practical applications would the financing partners be mostly interested in? I think you have partly answered that one before in the last two slides, but
I think the financing partners, what they are interested in is they want to be part of the most advanced technology you can actually do. And these are accelerators, free interlacers, detectors, because only by participating in this kind of advanced infrastructure, you really get the technology. You need to do it yourself, and then you also they open up the these facilities are then a tool for the user groups, for the university groups, that they can do the most advanced science that is possible these days, and thereby also train in the best way their students.
Okay. And then one more. In one of your slides, you had this tiny bubble called X-ray optics.
Yeah.
How do you do optics with a beam that can evaporate solid steel?
Yes, that's a very good question. Actually, the beam, we have, when the beam is born, then it's about, in the undulator, it's about some few microns big. But then it's a slight divergence. So then we let it then we let it run for about 1 kilometer. And after 1 kilometer, the beam is bigger. And then it could be maybe a millimeter. And then you can put in a lens. And you can either have a lens or a mirror, a bent mirror, or a lens to focus the beam again. And when you focus, and then that there the lens can actually take the beam. The lens is made up of beryllium, which absorbs the X-rays. Or you have a mirror, which is reflecting all the X-rays, so very little is penetrating the mirror. So there you can actually handle the beam. But as soon as you focus the beam, you cannot stop it anymore.
Yes. Okay. That concludes the questions. Thank you again for the talk.